We're here on case 11-2073 and 11-2160. Lori LeBlanc et al. Versus Wells Fargo Advisors. For the appellants, Mr. Brannon?
Correct. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for a rebuttal. This was brought up on both a conflict and discretionary appeal to this court. The court framed the issue as such: in a dispute between a specifically designated and two clearly intended beneficiary of an IRA, where the account custodian files an interpleader action and purportedly waives compliance with its change of beneficiary procedures, is the clearly intended beneficiary required to show that the owner of the IRA account substantially complied with the change of beneficiary procedures in order to recover? I'll assert to the court that the answer is no, and basically ask the court to affirm the decision that's already been handed down of the Ninth District and Kelly v. May Associates. The Second District essentially disagreed with numerous aspects, and I think we should probably go through those. Initially, the Second District indicated they would not extend the law and treat IRAs such as the law for insurance policies. In insurance cases, when there's a dispute between beneficiaries, the custodian or insurer is allowed to interplead those proceeds, wash their hands of any liability, and say, court, figure it out based on intent. The Second District flat out rejected that holding and extensions of law. I noticed that in the appellee's brief that they keep citing to the Uniform Transfer on Death Security Registration Act, and that act is uniform, and it's applied in numerous other jurisdictions like Texas, North Carolina, New York, and those jurisdictions went ahead and extended the law treating IRAs just as they would life insurance policies. So in that respect, I have a hard time finding that this court's going to agree with the Second District and not treat IRAs IRA law the same when there's a dispute that arises.
Could you just briefly summarize the facts that weigh in favor of your client?
John Birchfield was married for 2 years, and in that time he changed all of his IRAs, and the subject of this dispute, to his wife, his new wife. That lasted for about 2 years, and there were problems with the marriage. He essentially indicated to his financial advisor at Wells Fargo through email that he would like to take Cynthia Birchfield off of his IRAs. There was a response that said, fine, go ahead and tell me how you want to designate those IRAs. There was a subsequent conversation between the Wells Fargo broker and John Birchfield where he orally indicated how to reestablish the beneficiaries and change the beneficiaries, taking Cynthia Birchfield off of that off the beneficiary form. Wells Fargo then auto-populated a change of beneficiary form and mailed it to the decedent. It designated, I think it was 3/4, 75% to John Birchfield's mother, 25% to his father, and mailed John Birchfield the form. John Birchfield got the form, he signed it, and failed to mail it in. This occurred before a divorce action was filed against him, and he had done those changes on the beneficiary forms and discussed these issues with Wells Fargo. And then, unfortunately, he killed himself.
So if we accept your view, I assume you want us to follow the Ninth District's decision in Kelly. If we accept your view, that puts you back at the trial court, because there's a question of fact, right? He signed the documents, but they weren't found until after he had died. And so there's a question of fact of his intent, because simply signing them and failing to mail them becomes an issue. So is that what you're asking us to do?
That's exactly what I'm asking this court to do, is send it back to determine his intent and only his intent. The Second District went ahead and tacked on an additional test that John Birchfield had to substantially comply with the procedures and policies set forth by Wells Fargo. And that is contrary, of course, to what the Ninth District said, but it's also contrary to the statute. 1709, the Uniform Act, doesn't require any kind of substantial compliance. The purpose of allowing a financial institution like an insurance carrier or custodian of an IRA to interplead funds is simply to allow that custodian to waive liability. It's saying, I don't have an interest here. I'm not going to get hit by either of these contested beneficiaries, and they step back and let the court decide based on the intent of the decedent analysis.
So are you saying that by interpleading the funds, the insurance company is basically admitting that substantial compliance has occurred?
No. In fact, it's waiving any compliance with any of its policies and procedures. You know, the sign, you have to sign a writing or something to that effect. Wells Fargo is saying, I don't care. We're not, court, you figure this out. We're not going to make anybody follow our procedures. And they do that for a number of reasons. And it's been a century of precedent that says an insurance carrier is allowed to waive liability in order to avoid that liability from each side of the beneficiaries. And there's secondary benefits as to why a custodian or insurance carrier would want to be able to waive its own policies. And of course, the statute in Ohio clearly says under 1709.10 that they can make their own procedures up. The secondary benefit would be to accomplish the wishes of the client. In this case, John Birchfield had a longer relationship with his advisor at Wells Fargo. And Aaron Michael, the advisor I'm talking about, did everything he could possibly do in order to accommodate his client's last wishes. He changed the form. He talked to him. He pleaded with Wells Fargo. But Wells Fargo essentially said, we're not going to get in the middle of this, and then sought the interpleader. The point of that is Wells Fargo should be allowed to not be constrained by their own policies and waive these policies because they want to accomplish what the decedent wanted in the first place. And if I go to my financial advisor, I want to be able to make sure that my wishes are taken care of and I don't end up shooting my money to Amsterdam because I checked the wrong box. There is that fear. And so they are protected in accomplishing their twofold objective. This is Wells Fargo, of avoiding liability while at the same time accommodating their client's
wishes. Counsel, if we do follow the 98th Circuit and it goes back to the trial court to determine the intent of the decedent here with what he wanted to do with this IRA, and say it was his intent to change the beneficiaries, and then because Wells Fargo is waiving their requirement that they receive a signed document, you know, prior to, I would say, his death, if they waive that, then the intent will be decisive as to what happens with these dollars. Who gets the dollars? Is that correct?
That's correct.
That's the way you envision it working.
Absolutely.
That's the way it works on insurance cases right now.
The
correct?
Same way, which is how the Ninth District went ahead and interpreted it. They based it on intent. In that case, the decedent picked up the phone and called the custodian. The custodian sent out a writing to get her signature. The signature never made it back in to the custodian, and they still decided that intent is what controlled, and that is key.
But doesn't substantial compliance relate to the intent? Isn't it something that should be factored into by the trial court? I mean, here you have the email, I think, happening. He emails in October of 2009. The information comes back to him November 5th, and he dies on December 16th.
Right.
And never the papers are found, but they're never put in the mail. Doesn't the substantial compliance of making sure he follows through by putting the document in the mailbox, doesn't that relate to the intent?
Well, I think you can only look at the facts to insinuate the intent. But substantial compliance here, if it's required to follow Wells Fargo's procedures substantially, then why not just make them follow through, make Wells Fargo follow through with their procedures? I mean, that's basically what it means, is they're forcing the account holder to follow the procedures. That doesn't protect Wells. Wells has the ability to waive their procedures. And this substantial compliance test was tacked on by the Second District, and essentially it was the Ninth District didn't require it. They certainly didn't say, we're going to make you substantially comply. In fact, they based their decision on extending the law to IRAs, with interpleader. They looked at RINLAB, and if you actually look at the language in RINLAB, the only thing it says is the substantial compliance is, and this is on page 306, is entirely reasonable to infer that he, being the decedent, believed he had done all that was necessary to effectuate a change in the beneficiary. That sounds like a subjective test to me. I was told by the Second District that, well, he didn't mail the letters, so he didn't substantially comply with the policy. Well, in the Ninth District, she only made a phone call. She didn't fill out anything. There were no emails, oral conversations, no other writings to that effect.
Mr. Brannon, it occurs to me that this seems to be a highly factual situation, and there's disputed questions about it. But we're not really a fact-finding body, and we're supposed to make a determination about what the law is here. So in doing that, what are you asking us to write? Are you asking us to look and see whether or not substantial compliance is a component here? Or what do you want us to do? What do you want us to write?
The Second District invented the substantial compliance test with regard to IRAs. I mean, first they said the IRAs and IRA cases, we're not going to apply that insurance law where the interpleader happens and then the procedures are waived. So I want you to first...
So you're suggesting that the Second District has applied a substantial compliance requirement, which is not a part of the statute.
Correct.
And you want us to simply declare that that is...
It's too far. It's legislation, for one thing, because the Second District tried to, or at least if you read the opinion, they based their law on, we're not rejecting Red Lab, the Supreme Court authority,
Other than correcting the mistake that you think the Second District made, what do we write for all the rest of the courts in Ohio?
There's no requirement of substantial compliance. Upon an interpleader by either an insurance carrier or an IRA custodian of proceeds in a dispute between potential beneficiaries, then the court is to determine the clearly expressed intent of the decedent in order to award those proceeds to the proper beneficiary. There is no intent of the decedent analysis. You can get at some of the substance of substantial compliance by looking at the facts of what he did.
So it's indicia of intent that you look for, and the compliance may or may not be indicia of intent.
Right. The substantial compliance test is not necessary, and it also inhibits the whole point of the public policy of protecting the banks. It's basically putting the onus to do the complying on the owner, whereas the whole point of waiver is to give the banks the authority to follow its policy or not follow its policy. This is basically forcing the owner to substantially comply with those policies of change of beneficiary procedures, if that makes sense. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Berkshire?
Thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor. May it please the court. There are two prongs to the discussion here today that I'd like to touch upon. First of all, I'll start with the substantial compliance matters that the court inquired of the appellant's counsel with. The appellants are conflating the interpleading procedure available to a financial institution or a custodian of a life insurance policy or an IRA with the owner's obligations to substantially comply with the contractual procedures set out in the IRA account contract in order to change their designated beneficiary.
Should we look at the owner's intent?
The owner's intent is as expressed pursuant to Revised Code Chapter 1709 in the signed designation of beneficiary documents that are provided for by his contract, in this case or in others. And if you look at
so this becomes a factual question as to what the owner intended, and that would be determined in a trial court.
No, Your Honor. This is a matter of law, because under Chapter 1709, the contract under which the IRA account was established governs these transactions. In fact, in this court's decision in Belot versus Belot, which was to my knowledge, the only case holding upon or ruling on any aspect of Chapter 1709, that case was specifically directed to the constitutionality of the statute.
So you're basically taking the position, and the Court of Appeals seems to be as well, that the fact that he knew this divorce was pending, he called his broker, got the documents, signed them, put them in an envelope, but did not mail them back, does not fulfill the contract. He has not substantially complied. And if, in fact, he had mailed them back, we wouldn't have a case.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So yours is a pretty black letter. You have to mail them back, and it has to be completed. There's really no intent argument. There's no Why would there even be an interpleader?
Your Honor, the interpleader was essentially Wells Fargo's decision to do exactly what interpleader is intended to do, allow the disputing parties to the funds to have their day in court while it steps back with no liability to itself.
But your day in court says there's absolutely, I mean, you have to follow the contract. You can't, Wells Fargo doesn't have the ability to waive any provision of the contract. So if he didn't send it back, end of story, he's done.
Your Honor, in essence, the legislature, in enacting Chapter 1709, has said exactly that. In
How did we develop our body of insurance law then? Because insurance contracts are in the same boat.
Well, insurance contracts haven't been subject to a specific enactment of statutes such as the IRAs here. And, in fact, as we've gone to lengths to point out, there are substantial differences between IRAs and life insurance contracts. In fact, the federal statute that first created the 401k and the IRA type of accounts specifically excludes life insurance contracts from the assets that can be included in an IRA.
So there's really no intent in your analysis. There's no intent issue or anything. It's strict contract adherence. If they don't, tough luck.
In essence, Your Honor, it may sound callous, but as this court recognized in Belot versus Belot, the purpose of these statutes was to protect the contractual rights of the parties to the statute.
Anywhere in the statute that says you can't waive a term of the contract?
No, Your Honor, there is not. However, there are no facts upon which to suggest that Mr. Burchfield, in this instance, wished to waive the requirements of the contract. In fact, he requested change of beneficiary forms in compliance with the contract.
Wells Fargo is the waiving party here, not Mr.
Mr. Burchfield?
Burchfield, yes.
Well, Your Honor, that's the conflating argument that the appellants are making here. What Wells Fargo is entitled to do for its own protection, and this is entirely consistent with 1709-08C.
Well, I don't know that it's being characterized as its own protection. What I heard opposing counsel say is that a relationship was present between the decedent and his broker, I think it was Mr. Michaels, was that the name?
Aaron Michael is his name.
And this was an obligation that Mr. Michaels felt he was taking on behalf of his longtime client.
Mr. Michael is an employee of Wells Fargo, Your Honor. What his deposition testimony suggested was that he tried to turn in the change of beneficiary designation forms that were discovered in Mr. Burchfield's belongings after his death, and after Mr. Burchfield's death caused Wells Fargo to change the designated beneficiary, which clearly, under Revised Code Section 1709-08, would not be an appropriate procedure, especially in light of the fact that in this case, Wells Fargo was aware that there were disputes between parties as to who was the designated beneficiary. What this comes down to, Your Honors, is the appellants have repeatedly suggested in their pleadings, both here in the argument today, that Wells Fargo would somehow be subjected to duplicative liability if the contractual terms and conditions in this case were to be applied as the Second District Court of Appeals determined and as Chapter 1709 requires. The reality is the only way that any IRA custodian can incur duplicative liability is if they ignore the contract in exactly the manner the appellants are suggesting. If the court were to adopt the components of the waiver argument the appellants suggest here, it would not only be flying entirely in the face of the legislative intent in enacting these statutes, but it would also miss the point of the statutes, the case law from this court that the appellants rely upon for their arguments. Specifically, I would point you to Atkinson versus Metropolitan Life and Rindlaw versus Travelers. In each of those cases, the actual determination from the court as to how, after interpleader has occurred, the determination of the designated beneficiary is to be made is to look at what the insured, or in this case, if you analogize this to insurance law, what the insured did to meet their obligations.
I really would like to understand your argument, because I feel like you're conflating some terms for us. 1709 does not prohibit Wells Fargo from waiving the terms of compliance with their own contract. So please, and then so you go through, you say 1709 prohibits, and then you get into the facts. The issue is, can Wells Fargo waive strict compliance with its own contract? We've previously said in the context of insurance law that's permissible. So can you articulate for me what your argument is to this court?
Certainly, Your Honor. Wells Fargo can, by interpleading the funds into the court, as it elected to do in this instance, waive the requirement that it receive assigned designation of beneficiary form. Okay. And it can ask a trial court to determine who the ultimate designated beneficiary is. However, Wells Fargo cannot, under either existing case law from this court or under Chapter 1709 of the Ohio Revised Code, Wells Fargo cannot, by interpleader, waive the owner of the IRA account's obligations under the contract. It cannot waive the requirement that they substantially comply with the procedures for changing their designated beneficiary.
Wells Fargo can waive their requirement to receive a written change of beneficiary form.
Yes.
And you're saying that they can't waive it. If they're waiving their requirement to receive a change of beneficiary form, doesn't that relieve the owner of the contractual obligation to supply that change of beneficiary form?
No, Your Honor.
Well, who would the owner supply the beneficiary form to if Wells Fargo says, we don't need it?
The waiver is as in between Wells Fargo and the contesting designated beneficiaries. In other words, one of those beneficiaries can't argue that Wells Fargo is liable if they pay this money to the other contesting beneficiary because Wells Fargo refused because Wells Fargo failed to impose its receipt or...
Has Wells Fargo waived its right to receive this document?
Wells Fargo has never taken a position one way or the other, Your Honor. Interpleader protects it, and it waives
its interest. Is Wells Fargo insisting that it has to be there?
No. What the Second District Court of Appeals did, and what the substantial compliance test case law requires, is evidence that the insured, in order to demonstrate their intent, that the insured, or rather in this case the owner, did everything they could do in order to comply with their obligations.
Justice O'Donnell just got right down to the pavement with you, and your answer was no. They haven't taken a position, but you are here taking a position adverse to one of the parties and in favor of the other.
But I'm not
arguing it fairly vigorously. So, therefore, Wells Fargo has taken a position, is taking a position. They're
Your
paying
Honor,
you to take a position.
Your Honor, I don't represent Wells Fargo.
You don't?
No, I represent Cynthia Birchfield, the appellee.
I'm sorry.
And what Wells Fargo has done is put this case with the court for determination between the two contesting parties and step back.
So you're saying that Wells Fargo owes a responsibility, a duty, a contractual obligation, not only to the decedent, but to the named beneficiary in the first instance?
After
Your
the
client.
Owner of the IRA passes away, they certainly do.
Okay.
Upon their death.
So you're contesting that Wells Fargo's statement that we don't need to have a changed beneficiary form that was laid out in our original agreement with the decedent. We have according to our satisfaction, indications of his intent, and that's good enough for us.
That is not my argument, nor are those the facts in this case, Your Honor. The appellants, Ms. LeBlanc and Gloria Welch, have, in essence, attempted to procedurally force a waiver upon Wells Fargo by instituting an action here. All right. Wells Fargo, in response to that and in compliance with 1709-08C, interpled the money to the court and asked the court for a determination as to whether my client, Mrs. Birchfield, or the appellants are the appropriate and lawful designated beneficiary.
What was Wells Fargo's response to, do you need a written signed document by the decedent in order to do the transfer? They say, we don't care. Court, you figure it out.
That's
basically,
right.
Basically, court, you figure it out. So in order to figure it out, the appellant is asking, let's send this whole thing back to the trial court, let the trial court figure out what the intent was of the decedent, and the trial court will determine what the indicia of that intent is, and it may or may not be a signed document.
But according to opinions from this court, if we're going to analogize to life insurance policies, according to opinions of this court, that is not the sole analysis. You have to then look to the substantial compliance test, which is, did the insured, or in this case the owner, do everything they were able to do under the circumstances to effect a change of their beneficiary?
And isn't that something that is, for the court to figure out? Did the decedent do everything he could have done under the circumstances? And then they're going to hear all about the circumstances from the first time he, you know, contacted the broker until, you know, the last day he was alive. What was going on? And in light of those circumstances, was that intent evidenced?
Your Honor, if you look to both the trial court decision and the Second District Court of Appeals decision, all of those facts were construed in the appellant's favor. And it came down to a very simple set of facts. He had been provided not only with change of beneficiary forms, he'd also been given a self-addressed stamped envelope in which to return those forms to Wells Fargo, and did not do so. So even when construing all the facts in favor of the appellants at every point in this case, the determination is that he did not, the legal determination from two courts, was that he did not do all that he could do under the circumstances.
So it seems to me that what we really have is an issue of two courts deciding that the substantial compliance required mailing them back, whereas the other side is saying that's just one of the issues to look at. This should have gone past summary and gone to trial.
Well, that's the appellant's position.
That's their position.
Certainly.
And the trial court and the court of appeals bought your position, was that if he didn't put it back in the mail, he didn't substantially comply, we're entitled.
Well,
that's your position.
That was one of the two prongs of the Second District Court of Appeals decision. The second was that the contract governs in this case pursuant to revised.
And they're giving no out for, basically, they gave no out for intent. It's all contract compliance.
Exactly. It's the, and as the court
stated, the legal issue we have to reach is, does the contract control with no intent factor, or does it go back for determination of intent, of which substantial compliance is an issue, rather than the determinative factor? Because in their case, you don't have to even get to intent because he didn't mail them back, end of story, under the way the Court of Appeals interpreted it.
Well, in essence, Your Honor, and for the same reason that this court ruled similarly in a case involving payable on death accounts, reliability, certainty, and predictability, which is exactly what the legislature intended by enacting Chapter 1709.
So I'm a little confused about the term between substantial compliance and strict compliance, because it sounds to me if they're requiring that it be mailed back to the bank, or excuse me, to Wells Fargo, that's 100% compliance, isn't it? Fill it out correctly, put it in the mail, send it back. That's strict compliance with the contract, not substantial.
Your Honor, it isn't necessarily, depending upon the document that you're dealing with. These forms vary from IRA provider to IRA provider. Some of them, such as in this instance, require a signature of a spouse if you're married, and in the same way that you might disclaim any rights or other interests in your spouse's assets if you're going to encumber them for some reason. This form didn't have those signatures on it. However, where the Court of Appeals came down to essentially on the substantial compliance issue, which is separate and distinct from the Chapter 1709 issue in this case, is that under these circumstances, especially given the fact that when Mrs. Birchfield was designated as the beneficiary by Mr. Birchfield, he knew exactly what was required. He signed the forms and he faxed them to Wells Fargo, to the same individual. In this instance, he knew exactly what was required. Construing the facts most favorably and for the appellants, the assumption was made that he signed the forms, but for whatever reason, he either chose or failed to make any attempt to return those forms. So he didn't do everything required of him under the circumstances.
Thank you.
I was going to say, could we analyze this sort of as a summary judgment situation where there still may be questions of fact, material questions of fact?
I would respectfully suggest not, Your Honor. All of the questions of potential material fact were construed in the appellant's favor. And even when that happens, the substantial compliance test is not met, and certainly full compliance under Chapter 1709 is not met.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just to answer a couple of factual questions. When I ask Aaron Michael in deposition, after what John Birchfield did, who gets the money? He says, no question, it's the appellants, and not who actually received one of the second district. He said he thought he did everything he had to do to comply.
Counsel, was the envelope sealed? Apparently it was self-addressed and stamped. Was it sealed?
I'm comfortable it was sealed. I'm pretty darn sure of that. It sounds like the appellee is trying to make the argument, and this is wholly inaccurate and goes against precedent, that the contingent beneficiary has an expectancy interest and has a right to actually challenge the contract between Wells Fargo and John Birchfield. That's never been held the case. In fact, that's the whole point of this interpleader. I know he mentioned Bidlatt, but in that case, that was an analysis of the Uniform Act under retroactive effect of the act on in that case. But I guess my point is, privity is what matters. John Birchfield had the contract with Wells Fargo, and no contingent beneficiary has the right to go in and mess with that contract, and that's exactly what they're saying. Regarding the statute, Justice McGee Brown, or Brown McGee, sorry, had it right.
The first time.
Okay. Had it right that nowhere in that statute is there any requirement for Wells Fargo to actually follow their policies. In fact, it expressly says under 1709 that they have a right to make up their own policies, and that is for the sole benefit of Wells Fargo or the custodian.
Counsel, I'm thinking, I don't recall, was an insurance case or a retirement benefit case. We had one in the recent past in which someone wanted to make changes like this, even got the forms, sent in the forms, didn't do it right. And back they come, and then a death occurs before they got the correct forms done. And I think our outcome was to say close enough there. In this case, are you really suggesting that once he calls the agent and says, I want this changed, that gets the outcome that you want for your clients?
That's exactly what happened in the Ninth District in the Kelly case. There was a phone call made, and that got the outcome I want.
So the papers, whatever their status, sealed or unsealed, are just tying up the process, in your view, that the phone call took care of it.
In a factual argument, it bolsters my position. So each of these emails, phone
calls. But did you lose that? That's what I'm not clear. Did you lose that argument already at the trial court level?
With the second district, who said I had to comply with the policy by virtually doing everything required by Wells Fargo, but it's not their call. It's Wells Fargo's call is what I'm stressing to the court. If they choose not to follow the requirements and their policies of signed writing, mailed in, and everything else, that's Wells Fargo's prerogative, and that is the law on insurance law, and I'm asking it to be extended in IRA law as
Counsel,
well.
Counsel, is the rationale given for the change of beneficiary important in this analysis? Because you said a telephone call is sufficient. Well, here it was an explanation. I'm getting a divorce. I want to, does she own the policy? I want to change the policy or the account.
I think I understand the question. The concerns can be addressed in an intent of the decedent analysis. It all comes into play, but it's, at the point that the funds are interpled and the courts to decide what's the clearly expressed intent here, then the parties can duke it out and argue their facts.
So all you're asking for is the overturning of the summary judgment and getting the chance to go to the trial court and have the issue of intent decided.
Right. Along with that would be a rejection of the substantial compliance requirement as espoused by the second district. And, of course, the ninth district never made that a requirement.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you adjourn court, please?
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned. Thank you.